Arizona Stories. I'm your host, Sean Ketchum. In this season, we're exploring entrepreneurship in Nashville. In each episode, I speak with a different founder to uncover their story and how that led to them starting their company. And today's episode is with Emily Mahoney. Emily is the co-founder of Branded Collective. And Branded is a very unique company. They handcraft pieces of jewelry, all of which are made by survivors of human trafficking. In today's show, Emily tells the story behind Branded and also goes into detail about her career as an actress. And just a couple of quick notes before we start. There was a little bit of interference in a few parts of the audio, and we were able to fix it some. But you may still hear a couple of parts that have a little distortion. I'm really sorry about this, but we've learned how to minimize this sort of thing for the future. Second, this episode contains a little bit of strong language. And while I don't always announce this in the intro, episodes that are beyond PG-13 will have a red E mark next to them on iTunes. So feel free to reference that if you have small children listening. Third, I'm proposing a panel to South by Southwest, which I would moderate next year if it's accepted. It's called Funding Female Founders and seeks to understand why women receive much less venture capital for their startups compared to men. If this sounds interesting to you, it would really mean a lot if you could vote for my panel, as it will increase its chance of being added to South by Southwest's programming. I'll pin a link where you can vote for it to the top of our Twitter page, which is @thestoriespod. And one last thing. If you'd like to view notes on this episode, or check out the photo I took of Emily, you can do both on the Stories website, which is thestoriespodcast.com. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Emily Mahoney. Emily, How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Georgia and in Tennessee. My dad is a Southern Baptist minister, so we moved a lot.
Okay.
So Georgia and Tennessee both feel like home to me.
In what state were you born?
Georgia.
Okay.
North Atlanta.
North of Atlanta or North Atlanta?
North Atlanta, yeah.
North Atlanta?
Yeah.
And is that where you went to grade school?
I was homeschooled, actually. Ah. So I went to grade school in my kitchen.
In your kitchen?
Yeah.
Of all places.
Of all places.
It's funny. I remember I wasn't homeschooled, but there was a kitchen in a house that I lived in growing up. There was like a chandelier or something, some sort of light fixture. I made it sound fancy with the chandelier, but a light fixture that hang right above our kitchen table.
Yeah.
But occasionally, I think every once in a while, my mom would move it in another room to like clean or something. And then I would walk and just like clock my head on it because it hung so low, you know, because it's a lower table. But enough about me. So you grew up North Atlanta, and Where were you at in Tennessee? What part of Tennessee?
Tennessee, we were in Donelson for a long while, and then Hendersonville, and that was probably it, Donelson and Hendersonville.
Okay, and for folks that aren't familiar with those, these are pretty close to Nashville, is that correct?
Yeah, Donelson is now like considered hip East Nashville.
Oh, is it?
At the time, it was kind of like danger zone and not cool at all.
Yeah. I hear these stories a lot. I remember when I first moved to Nashville, our cab driver was telling us we were pretty close to, I guess, what's called the Edge Hill neighborhood.
Yeah.
And he was like,
it was rough.
Oh man, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't walk around these parts without an AK-47. And so I hear these stories all the time where it seems like everywhere in Nashville was like, man, back in the day, you know, so.
Well, actually Donelson is why I was homeschooled so long. Cause my mom was going to put us in school in fourth grade, but then the schools in Donelson, they all had like barbed wire and kids there. Like the year that we were going to go to school, my sister and I, there was a shooting in the school that we were zoned to. And my mom was like, and we'll keep homeschooling. So
yeah,
fast forward 12 years and I was always homeschooled.
That's intense. So let's talk about homeschool a little bit. How were you able to make friends being homeschooled?
The not quite honest answer, but kind of true answer is I didn't have many friends. I didn't. No. But we went to a tutorial. So one day a week, I went to this little hippie school called Whitford Academy. And that was where a bunch of other homeschoolers on Thursdays would get together, and the kids would learn from different teachers. So, you know, once you hit middle school and high school, your mom may or may not be qualified to teach you every single thing you need to learn. So it was sort of like a transcendentalist style of education. It was really cool. I loved it. So those kids were definitely my friends. And then since I was a minister, there were people at church. I didn't like church, so I didn't really like those people very much. But my homeschool friends were good friends.
Mm-hmm. And when you said minister, you were talking about your father, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, he was the executive pastor of Southern Baptist mega churches.
Mm-hmm.
So think multiple gyms and cafes and smoke machines and like mega churches.
Gyms and cafes and smoke machines?
Yeah. What is this?
Oh, smoke machines, like you're talking about where they have a big performance and they like folks out there that may have never been to church, like when you're in the club and like they turn the smoke machine off.
That's
and
exactly
everything
what
starts
I'm talking
getting
about.
Fogged up.
Yeah, right. And like, so in case the congregation isn't feeling much during uh-huh. Amazing Grace, if you turn the smoke machine on,
let
suddenly
the Holy Spirit
everybody's
out.
Like, oh my God. Jesus.
Yeah. You really start feeling it then.
I mean, yeah, it's a great manipulative tool, that mm-hmm. smoke machine.
Mm-hmm. Was his father also a minister? Something I hear often when I meet pastors and things is, mm-hmm. you know, it seems like a long generation of pastors in the family. Is that the case
no.
with you?
His no? dad was a wealthy Southern socialite doctor who mm-hmm. had many affairs and didn't give a rat's ass about church.
I see.
So dad was, and my dad was a sort of like a, I haven't asked his permission to say this, but I won't say his name, but he was definitely like, you know, a sex, drugs and rock and roll guy. And then he found Jesus. And P.S., I don't mean to sound like bitter. I actually I do have my own faith now, but it's certainly not the smoke machine Southern Baptist Church. But no, I do not come from a legacy of ministers. I come from a legacy of doctors. Both of my grandfathers were Southern doctors.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, how has, let me ask this. What was it like being the daughter of a pastor growing up? Were there mm-hmm. certain expectations put on you?
Oh, very much so.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
I think, to be honest with you, I am only now beginning to realize the depth of that pressure and the way that to be a woman, to be Southern, and to be a minister's child were three sort of whammies for, you know, there was the spiritual expectation, the cultural expectation, the gender expectation. So, my response to the pressure was just to get very, very small. So here I am at 30, and honestly, I'm just now kind of beginning. This is a great question for me because I don't know the answer yet, is the honest truth, is that I think the church, one of the great disservices the church does, particularly to women, that may not be fair. I'm not a man, so I don't know. I have a brother, and I know he experienced a lot of pressure too, but in those mega churches that are very money-driven and institution-driven, everybody has a place. And I was a very inquisitive child, and I was very suspicious. I'm naturally a skeptic. I did not, you know, and I was reading the Bible and reading sort of commentaries about the Bible at a very young age, and it didn't take me long to realize, wow, there's two creation stories and they don't match up. What's that about? And I distinctly remember asking questions like that in Sunday school and just being met with silence. Or you know, the teachers rapidly moving toward prayer requests or whatever. I remember being asked in middle school to give my testimony. And I remember telling the teacher, I'm 12. Why would I give you my testimony? I have no testimony. But the expectation was, since I'm the minister's kid, I must be a Christian, so I must have a testimony. So, man, I think the pressure and the expectation when you're a minister's kid is huge. And I think that's why a lot of minister's kids, it's sort of a cliche to be the rebellious MK. Which mm-hmm. I wasn't. I was not the rebellious one. My sister was. I was more of the, I did everything right and was very, I chose, I guess, in the mega church to disappear as opposed to play all the cards right or to rebel. I just wasn't having it. I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the institution and I didn't like, I don't think I could identify the pressure. I just felt it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that totally makes sense. You mentioned something that I was really curious about. You mentioned asking questions,
mm-hmm.
and did you feel that asking questions about the Bible, those hard questions,
mm-hmm.
that it was unwelcomed or there really wasn't a safe place for that at your church, specific church growing up?
Very much so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was unwelcome. I felt like they were questions that, and, you know, looking back, I don't know if they were unwelcome because the people in my church were mean or uninterested in questioning the Bible. I think now that I'm on the other side of sort of the spiritual trauma of growing up in an institutional mega church, which small churches can have spiritual trauma too. I think perhaps the uninterest in question or the lack of question, had less to do with a blatant desire to be cruel to the curious and more to do with fear and maybe even some ignorance. I think a lot of people in the South had figured out a way to be nice and figured out a way to have a good life, and why rock the boat? And so, you know, why point out the inconsistencies in Scripture or the fact that God in the Old Testament is kind of terrifying? Mm-hmm. So I don't know why questions weren't welcome, because I had a lot of damn good questions.
Yeah.
But I distinctly remember asking a question in Sunday school once, and the very next week my Sunday school teacher pulled me aside at the end of class and gave me Rick Warren's A Purpose-Driven Life.
That's a book.
It's a book. Mm-hmm. And it's not a bad book. I think the book has done a lot for a lot of people, but I guess what I just mean to say is I was asking questions that were not answered in that book, but because that was like a very popular book at the time, I think she knew that I was curious and was asking questions, but the only way that she knew how to handle them was to, you know, to give me another book about how good God is. And I was really more curious about how bad God might be. And I think if you're not willing to consider the possibility that God is scary, then this is going to sound wacky, but I almost feel like if you're not willing to consider the possibility that God is scary, then you really have no right to tell me that he's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I felt anyway, and still feel.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about, if you feel comfortable with this, your faith now? I don't know what your beliefs are, but yeah, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question. And at the risk of sounding uninteresting, I think my answer is I don't know. I think I want to love God. I want to believe that there is a good God who, whatever that wonderful quote is, that we dwell under a friendly sky and the God of the universe is desperate to be friends with us. I love that philosophy. I think I am becoming to realize that I am not God, and that I need the help of a God, of some sort of a higher being. So I want to believe that he, she is out there. But I think that at the moment, what I'm doing is sort of deconstructing. I'm at a place in my life where I'm deconstructing what and who I was told God is. I think what I have to do, frankly, is create an empty space before I can fill it with any kind of God, because I think the one I was given is a misogynistic asshole. And until I can get that God out of my heart and my head, it's hard for me to have any space for the possibility of a good God that is good and scary. And I'm currently on that ride, but I'm just now beginning to see what that might even I guess I'm tearing down the old. So I really don't know what the new will be.
Okay. You mentioned inquisitive earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a lot of hobbies growing up?
Oh my gracious, I had so many hobbies. I painted and sketched and built model cars, and I was always building things with my hands. I love the arts. I loved building things. I loved, I started my first business. I think I was 14 or 15. I started a portrait business because I love sketching my friends or my siblings or my cousins. And here's the punchline of my hilarious first business. Guess what? My first pencil. So graphite was my favorite. And I love black and white. I love gray portraits. So guess what the name of my first business was?
What was it?
Shades of Gray.
Really?
Really? Isn't that funny? Shades of Gray was my first business. It didn't take off.
And you had 50 different markers.
I had 50. I had 50 different shades of gray. Yep.
Mm. What did you learn from your first business?
I think that one was just pleasure. I think I learned that I'm scared of failing. It was hardly a business, you know. Mm-hmm. I literally just printed off a few cards and gave, and mostly it was like sweet aunts and grandmothers that were like, oh, I want a portrait of whatever. So I don't know that I could say I learned anything business. But I think I learned that I liked it because I kept doing fun stuff like that. I mean, I enjoyed the thought of doing something that I loved and that other people would find enough pleasure in that they would pay me for it. Not that the money was what it was about necessarily.
So was it almost like the fact that someone would buy what you were doing, there was a stamp of validation that what you were doing was good?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, which might speak more to my deep insecurities than anything else. But I think there's nothing wrong with wanting someone to value your work.
Mm, very cool. So let's talk about college.
Yeah.
So where were you at when you finished high school? Let's say that first. Were you in Tennessee then?
I was. I was a high school homeschooler in Nashville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how many people were in your graduating class?
9.
So there were not, because you were going to the other...
Yeah, because I was at the tutorial when I graduated with 9 other people.
And how often did you guys meet with the tutorial program?
We met once a week on Thursdays, but then Tuesdays we had a biology lab at the Lipscomb campus. I guess that was just for the one semester, because mm-hmm. we did classes by semesters.
Could we talk about high school dating? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm curious, so... How did you meet guys in high school? Do you just pick the best looking guy out of the 9? Or, I mean, let's say half of them are guys, there's 4 guys.
I think there were 3 guys.
3 guys?
I did not date in high school very much at all, but I had a ton of friends that were guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not all in my grade. My 9 high school cohorts might laugh if they heard me say this because they might disagree, but I was kind of the girl that had a lot of guys that were friends. Like after school, the guys would go play Frisbee, and I really loved to play Frisbee, so it was usually me and the guys. So I was much more in high school. I was very practical, and I knew that I was young, and I knew that I wanted to hightail it to New York after high school.
Mm-hmm.
So I intentionally was not interested in dating. If somebody would pursue me, I would sort of brush it off because I thought, look, I'm going to New York, and I'm 15, 16, 17. This is stupid. That said, I did date one guy for like 2 months, and then he went to college.
2 months, that's a long time in high school.
It probably actually wasn't 2 months. that's a good thought. But it was one of those things where you don't really know, you know how in high school you don't know if you're dating, you're hanging out.
Oh, yeah.
So then when one of you finally is like, so kind of like you, then you're like, oh, man, how long have we really been, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I remember... Yeah, this one girl I was quote unquote hanging out with pretty early on in high school. We were on the phone one day, and I always thought of her as more like a friend, I guess, like a buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, yes, Sean, so how long have we been talking? Like 5 months or something? I'm like, what? We're talking. I didn't even know.
Define talking.
Yeah, I didn't even know we were quote unquote talking.
I know, right? Yeah. No, that's definitely how my high school was, for sure.
So let's talk about guy friends. Why did you have so many guy friends? What drew you to guys that you liked hanging out with them?
That's a great question. I think I'm very much, I am somewhat ADD, and I think I've never loved, now that I'm 30, I've changed my ways and I have some amazing girlfriends, but in high school I didn't love gossip. I still don't love gossip. That's not to say I don't stoop myself to gossiping, but I didn't love talking. I didn't love shopping. I didn't love hanging out the way that girls do, to be honest with you. So I loved hanging out with the guys because they were always going to the park probably I just loved Frisbee more than I loved the guys. Honestly, I just went where the Frisbee was.
The guys were doing the cool shit.
They really were. And they weren't talking about shit.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And I'm not saying I had some amazing girlfriends. I had 2 girlfriends, Mandy and Hillary, who are still 2 of my best friends in the whole wide world. And they were pretty rocking. And continue to be 2 of the most amazing people I know. But as far as like friend groups, it was usually the dudes.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, I want to talk about New York a little bit.
Yeah.
So after you finished high school, you moved to New York to go to college. Why did you want to go to New York?
Well, I actually, my first semester, I was at Belmont studying visual art.
And that's Belmont University,
Belmont
correct?
University.
And here in Nashville.
Here in Nashville, yeah. I've always wanted to be an actress, but I thought that was unreasonable, so I decided instead to be an artist. I was clearly not thinking very well. And I love art, but I hated it. I just knew that what I really wanted was to be an actress. So I applied for and auditioned for NYU, and I got accepted, and I went. I thought that I was going to be the next Katharine Hepburn, and I always wanted to go to New York. And this may be speaking too soon because, again, I'm like on a journey as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
But I think part of my desire to go to New York was because it was the farthest thing away from the Southern Baptist Institution that I could think of. I wanted to get far away from that. And I loved make-believe and pretend. I just love it. So mm-hmm. I wanted to go to New York and study that.
Were you in any productions in high school or earlier?
I was. Because I was homeschooled, the school didn't have a drama. Well, there was one semester that we had drama. We did Alice in Wonderland, and I was Alice, which was so fun. My grandmother's first role was playing Alice, too, so I'm always very proud of that. But I ended up working with Nashville Shakespeare Festival and Tennessee Rep, and I kind of had to get my feet wet in the professional world because, and that was a sort of a silver lining of being homeschooled, was that if I wanted to do theater, I had to get out and actually do it. So by the time I headed off to college, I had worked with Equity Houses.
Mm-hmm. What is Equity Houses?
Actors Equity is the union for actors. So it's a union headquartered in New York. And it protects it, you know, depending on how many hours a year you work, you get health insurance or, I guess it just works as a normal union. I don't know a lot about unions. Mm-hmm. It's the only one I'm a member of. Mm-hmm. But you pay small fees and then you get protection when you do a show. So you have to be paid a certain amount by a certain time, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. I was talking to a guy I know that's an actor, and yeah, he was telling me that, and correct me if this is wrong, if you're in a union, generally you're going to get paid a little bit more mm-hmm. than someone who's not in a union. Is that correct?
Yeah, it definitely depends. I think there are some contracts that sort of say that if anybody's in the show with an Equity actor, then everybody's paid the same.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't totally know how it works, but all I know is that it ensures that I get paid a certain amount.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Yeah. It also, though, the negative side of being part of a union is that if a company can't pay you, then they may not cast you.
And are you still acting now?
I am. Since the birth of Branded Collective, I have pulled back some. But yeah, I think I'll always act. It's something that I love and something that fills me up.
Do you have an agent?
I do.
So folks, if there's anyone out there working on anything and you go to the Stories website and you see the amazing photo I take of Emily, and you're like, that is a good headshot right there. We think she would fit perfect in this role. And I think we're going to get into this in a little bit. I think Emily does both film and plays. So if someone sees you and they want to get in touch, what's your agent name and what agency are they at?
This is so funny. Hey, thank you. My agent is the Avenue Agency, and it's here in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I only have Southeastern representation for film and television. For stage, I rep myself. That's usually actually how it works, at least in the Southeast. So.
Okay. So also, if there are other agents out there, I don't know if you're looking for an agent outside of the Southeast.
LA
she's,
agent.
She's single on the agent relationship. So let's talk about acting a little bit more. Actually, let's go back to New York. So you're moved to New York. You're studying acting at, mm-hmm. at NYU.
Is that,
what was your actual major? Drama mm-hmm. was your major?
BFA in, well, I guess a BFA in acting.
And that's,
yeah,
is that
Tisch?
Tisch? Okay.
Yep, Tisch.
Okay. BFA in acting. Now, what was your impression of New York when you first moved there, coming from down here in the South and in the outskirts of a little bit smaller city?
Honestly, I think I didn't realize what a culture shock it was until after. I mean, I went from being a Southern Baptist homeschool girl to going to NYU, where so many of my professors were different ethnicities, had, you know, what I thought was at the time, you know, unusual gender orientation, and the whole thing was just wild. But I think, to be honest with you, more than anything else, the thing that was the hardest was that most of the kids at NYU have a lot of money, and I never knew kids like that. And I think from my experience of life, and I could be very wrong, but I think the thing that makes people most different is not race or gender or age, it's money. And I was not used to that kind of person. I don't mean to say that money has to define people that much, but it certainly did at NYU.
Yeah. I felt the same way when I studied at UVA in Virginia, and I was at a junior college first, but when I transferred there, it definitely was a culture shock.
Yeah.
I actually broke down probably, like, I don't know how long I was there, maybe like 6 weeks, because it didn't feel real. It was like a bubble. There
right.
was a bubble. And yeah, you know, everyone, and this isn't going to be every single one, but you know, most of the people that are going there definitely come from wealthy families.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of people are really smart too. That also was a culture, like, it was really cool being around so many smart people.
Oh yeah.
So that was really inspiring. But aside from that, yeah, definitely a lot of people had a different life experience than I had growing
yeah.
up. And I could tell by just talking to people, they were completely unaware mm-hmm. of what some other people's childhoods were like.
It's so true. And what it took to go to that school. You know, my dad had to dip into his retirement to get me to that school.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that going to a school like that was the thing to do, you know, because that's what you're told if you get into NYU or Harvard or wherever. Go to those top 50 schools. They're the best. So you bend over backwards financially and accrue debt to get there, and all your classmates are, you know, fucking around and farting off and turning in late papers because it doesn't matter to them,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I'm sitting there, I took it so seriously, and, you know, graduated with honors and got a lot of, you know, the leading roles, because I was going to be damned if I didn't, you know? That was
mm-hmm.
like I was going to make every penny of my dad's retirement count. And it was so frustrating to me to be surrounded by some, not all by any stretch, but most, I felt, that were, they just didn't care. They liked to break the rules. They liked to not show up to class. They, you know, I think it was pocket change to their parents. So their hearts were not quite as serious as I wanted them to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a broader point there is just taking things for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think regardless of who you are, and I'll put myself in this bucket, you know, if there's something that actually might be a privilege that you might not even realize, you know, that there's so many things I think we really need to take a step back and be grateful for. Like, for example, a lot of people that are listening to this, I'd say probably most, you know, have running water and electricity,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's a lot of folks in the world that don't have that,
mm-hmm.
Both inside and outside the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say more in developing countries, but you know, it does happen. I mean, I did, yet points growing up, didn't have running water and didn't have electricity. And even the time period that we're living in right now, you know,
mm-hmm.
a couple hundred years ago, folks didn't have a lot of the luxuries, you know,
right.
and both with medicine wise and, you know, the infrastructure. So yeah, I think definitely gratitude is something that us as a culture, we need to spend a lot more time focusing on.
I think you're so right. And on the one hand, it's really humbling, because I think going somewhere like NYU, I'm grateful for it. I don't know that I wish I'd gone, to be honest with you. I don't know if I would recommend to any artist to spend that much money to go into debt to be an underpaid creative individual. I don't think I would recommend it, actually. But I am grateful for my experience, because I think now I can see situations in my life where I am essentially the one that has it all and that's
mm-hmm.
taking whatever it is for granted. You know, now working with survivors of human trafficking, it's very easy to go, wow, I totally have taken my car for granted. Or, because to me, taking something for granted is equivalent to just being ignorant. You know, I looked at a bunch of those wealthy kids at NYU and thought, man, they're so ignorant. They have no idea the pain and the sacrifice that I and my family are going through for me to be here. And I think I self-righteously looked at them as ignorant. And I would hope, now that I can sort of occasionally see that in myself, I guess I want to be able to cultivate a kind of, I guess, a more forgiving. It's hard to be grateful. It's hard to know you're taking something for granted, I guess. It's hard, like when
it's like you're blind.
Yeah,
it's like
when you've
always had it. It's like a blind spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know. It's fun. Like, I don't know how you cultivate gratitude for something you've always had and don't, until you maybe encounter someone
mm-hmm.
that doesn't have it.
Yeah, I have a couple of ideas about that. You know, and one thing is, regardless of where you live, most people, if you live near a big city, I think this is going to be true. For folks that are living really deep rural areas, it might be, this might not be as easy to get to, but yeah, there are struggling communities, you know, all over the world. Mm-hmm. So if you live here in the U.S., like we do, there are struggling populations that, and there are organizations that you can get plugged into in your community to help. One thing that I'm really pushing is mentorship. I think mentorship is really valuable because there's a lot of at-risk young people that are going to be the next generation, mm-hmm. and that don't have any positive role models in their life or absent parents.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other folks that don't, it's not close enough to them. It's not enough in their face that they realize that. And I think there's a lot of good people out there that I think it could be beneficial for these kids to connect, a lot of positive adults. So I'm always trying to encourage people to, if they're not already doing so, to connect with, you know, just one young person that you can meet, you know, once a week or once every couple of weeks in your community, that you might be able to, at least, if anything, be a little bit of a glimmer of light in their life. Another thing I would say is go to a really poor country. You know, take a trip there and try to spend some time with locals. Like, don't stay in, you know, the fanciest hotel, but go and really try to connect with the community. Go, you know, connect with an organization, for example. Like, I think Charity Water might, mm-hmm. And I don't know if Blood Water does this because we're in Nashville. I'm going to shout out Blood Water too. But I think they may do trips where, you know, you can, you know, go over to a poor country and help a village or something dig a well. And I think getting over there and seeing people and face to face, struggling and making that personal connection, I think really resonates. Cause I personally don't think that, you know, even let's say we were talking about some wealthy folks at our schools and things like that. I don't even think it's as much that people don't care. I think it's just that it's not enough in people's face. It's not close enough to them that they can empathize.
Yeah.
Cause I think to have empathy, it's difficult when you can't see what's happening. And I definitely want to get, as we go through the interview, I definitely want to get, talk more about Branded Collective and what you're doing with the survivors there. But yeah, it's one thing to hear about an organization or see something online. It's another thing to meet someone face to face and hear their personal story and see a flesh human being in front of you that you can have a conversation with. Those two things I definitely would encourage folks, you know, connect with.
I think that's very true.
At-risk communities in your local area, as well as if you have the opportunity to take some sort of trip to a poor country and work on a project, I would definitely encourage folks to do those things just to help foster empathy.
Yeah. Another great one is Mission Lazarus. I'll just throw out their name. They have a tannery in Honduras, and you can go and we're about to collaborate with them, and they really do phenomenal work.
What do they do? Could you talk about what they do?
Well, I wish that one of their reps was here so they could tell you better. I don't want to misspeak, but they have a tannery in Honduras, and they make beautiful leather bags and leather wraps or bands or various leather goods, and I think some textiles of various things. And they're providing jobs to, I don't know what population it is that they help in Honduras. I don't know. I know they have a school for children, but I'm not sure that they would be employing the kids. So I'm not one to speak in detail about what they do, but they're helping a community in Honduras with education and with job opportunity. So they're pretty rocking.
Could you say the name of that organization one more time?
Mission Lazarus.
And are they missionlazarus.org possibly?
I think so.
Okay. Well, either way, folks, I think folks listening probably pretty good at Googling.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely.
It'll come up.
Definitely check that organization out.
We have ethically made farmed coffee beans that are delicious. So
very
there's
cool.
that too. Yeah.
Very cool. Okay. So let's take it back to New York again.
Right. Okay.
So you were you working on productions while you were in college?
Yeah, I did. I did a lot of Shakespeare in college. I did Twelfth Night, was Viola in Twelfth Night, which was probably the highlight of college. I did a strange new work for the main stage there at Tisch that I still have no idea what it was about. NYU was all into these, like, you know, abstract New York plays, and I pretended while I was there like I liked them, and I have no idea what the hell any of them were about. They were usually like lots of profanities and some nudity and like, you know, people getting on stage and like speaking these eloquent speeches that mean absolutely nothing. And I was always like, I would much rather be doing Shakespeare.
That sounds very NYU. I've never been, but just the vibe I get when I'm around NYU and the Village, definitely, it definitely sounds like that.
I know. I think everybody was tripping, but I'm sure that there was some beauty to those plays. I'm sure. Because, mm-hmm. It's a community of very creative, very smart people, but I never got any of it. And I just had to like fake my way through the bohemian experience because I'm still just a country girl. And I was like, I love me some Shakespeare and some Clifford Odets and some Ibsen or however people say his name. I was not into the experimental theater. That's what it was. Experimental. I had no idea what that was about. Anyway, what's your next New York question?
My next New York question is, so you graduate from Tisch.
I did. Graduated from Tisch.
And what do you do after that?
After that, I studied at a school called Atlantic Acting something conservatory, and they taught a particular method of acting called practical aesthetics, and it wasn't working for me. I didn't love it. It was very much, in fact, NYU felt to me a lot, it was like the opposite side of the Southern Baptist coin. It was a big institution, and it took itself way too seriously, and I drank the Kool-Aid, much like I did with Southern Baptist. I mean, I took myself very seriously, and I wanted to be the best wherever I was, so I really dove into NYU, and I don't know, I guess I wanted to be the best, and I kind of was. But on the other side of it, I felt like I had really lost something. I felt like I forgot how to enjoy telling a story and play pretend. I felt like I was an actor, and I wasn't a pretender, and I wanted to play pretend again. I wanted to find that stuff that I lost as a kid. So I studied with a man named Wynn Handman. He is currently still teaching in New York. He's like 98 or something.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a phenomenal teacher. He's taught Denzel Washington and Dustin Hoffman and Annette Bening, and he's just been around for ages, and he was much cheaper, but had a pretty rigorous audition process to get to work with him, and I had the honor of working with him for 5 months, and I feel like he taught me how to play pretend again.
Now, you mentioned pretend. Could you describe to folks the distinction you're making between pretend and acting?
Yeah, I think the easiest way for me to say it, for me, and I guess everybody may have a different way into that thought, but for me, acting is about being seen. And to me, playing pretend is about seeing. And I think that the best storytellers don't take themselves. I think it was Alan Rickman that said something about take the work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. Something like that. I have no idea if it was him, but I like him, so I'm going to credit him with that. So I like, to me, pretending, it doesn't matter if I do the work well. It doesn't matter if I win an award. It doesn't matter if you think I'm a great actor or if I'm wooden or not. What matters is that you leave the theater or the credits roll at the end of the film, and you're talking about your own life. You're not talking about my performance. In fact, I think I've done a really bad job if at the end of the movie you're like, wow, she's a great actress. What I'd much rather you be doing is saying, oh my God, that character reminds me so much of my mom, and that breaks my heart. And then, and then you're on this journey thinking about yourself or inspired to change or whatever. I really think Oscar Wilde has this awesome quote, and I'm going to mess it up, so I'm not going to try and quote him. But he talks about how the best art erases the artist. You don't see the artist. That's why I think celebrity wreaks havoc on storytelling. So I guess that's, to me, that's the difference, that pretending is not about the artist. It's about the story. It's about seeing, not about being seen. And acting is all about being seen.
Mm-hmm.
So
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't see.
You don't see. No, you do see. You do.
Okay, so you start out with plays, but you eventually get into commercials and film as well, correct?
Yeah.
Could you talk about that transition?
Mm-hmm. Well, I left New York so my lease was up in 2010, and I wanted to come home for the holidays and just take a break for like a couple of months and then go back to the grind. And when I came back to the South, I just fell in love again, and I forgot how much I loved it, and I forgot how...
How much you loved what?
The South.
The South, okay. Uh-huh.
And maple trees and friends and family and just being in the South. So, 2 months turned into here I am, I guess, 7 years later. So in that time, when I was taking a break from acting, I connected with my current agent, The Avenue, and just thought, well, I'll do a few little commercials here and there just to make some money, start paying back NYU the mountain of debt that I owe them. And I loved it. I didn't do any film when I was at NYU, which I wish I had. I wish I'd been more, I was such a serious student that I didn't experiment. I just stuck to the things that I wanted to master, which was, I think, a loss for me actually. But anyhow, I think I started doing film a little bit because I wanted to just make a little money. And then from there, I was really pleasantly surprised by how much fun it is, how I love telling stories. I love being able to use my full instrument. I love being able to whisper or being able to just move an eyebrow and that communicates something to you. And on stage, I feel, and a lot of stage actors would think that what I'm about to say is blasphemy, but I feel like sometimes I have to compromise the choices I really want to make for the story in order to reach the last row or be heard. So, you know, on stage, you have to speak at a certain volume and move at a certain size in order to communicate. In film, you don't have to do that at all. Or it's the other way around, where you have to be sure that you have to make smaller choices. As it turns out, I really love that. So from there, I've just kept doing it. And the South has quite a bit going on, actually. It's a really great place to be a film actor.
What was your first non-commercial film or TV that you've done?
I was on an episode of The Game on BET Network in Atlanta. So I went down and played the white bitch in...
No, BET. We're talking about BET, uh-huh. Black Entertainment Television.
We are totally talking about BET.
I was like, BET?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you were the...
I played Vicky something on an episode of BET. And
were
I
you kind of... Was this... Yeah, I see like you got a little...
I was a Jersey Shore, like, rich woman.
They rich, okay.
Yeah, they put, like, bling all over me and fake boobs.
Okay.
And, I mean, I have no idea how I got that role. I think it's hilarious. I joked with the casting director about how I smelled like onions because I'd just eaten a sandwich, and I think maybe that did it.
And what were you doing in that show, like?
I was playing a sunbeam, so I was the wife. That show has something to do with football players, and I was the wife of a football player, and so I was a sunbeam, which is, like, the wife's club, and I was just totally bitchy to the new girl. Uh-huh. So that's all. I just played a bitch and it was so much fun.
And this was a majority African American cast?
Oh, yes. Cool. Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. cool. Who've been some of the one or two people that you've worked with? It could be other actors or anyone in film that you really enjoyed working with. Like, who are they and what did you like about that experience?
I loved working with an actress named Dervila Molloy. She is Irish. I just did a play in DC called Moment by Deirdre Kinahan, and it's an Irish play. And Dervila is an older actress who is friends with some big, huge names in Ireland and in England. She is a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company and has worked with just a lot of biggies that we all know. And I was very intimidated, and she's been around for a long time, doing extraordinary work for a long time. And I actually took the lead in that play. And she played my mom, which I guess was sort of a supporting role to my character. Everybody had a huge role, but it felt like I was so intimidated when I found out that she was in the play that I assumed that I was actually playing the understudy for the lead, because this woman, I've just thought she was extraordinary for a long time. And she ended up being one of the most kind, generous, professional, did not take herself seriously, but took the work very seriously, artist. And it was a delight to work with her. I actually hurt my foot in rehearsal one day, and she ended up getting on her knees and like wrapping my ankle for me.
Wow.
And she was just that humble of a woman and yet like a total spitfire.
Mm.
So she's probably my most recent highlight.
Very cool.
Yeah.
We were talking about plays and acting, and it reminded me of a story. I took a semester off from UVA when I was an undergrad and went and studied at Oxford University.
Oh, cool.
At this college called St. Catherine's College. Shout out to Cats. with a Z on the end.
Cats.
And so Patrick Stewart actually was a visiting professor there the year I was studying abroad. And so I remember being in my dorm. And my roommate says, "Yeah, so are you going to Patrick Stewart's thing tonight?" I was like, "What thing?" He's like, "Yeah, he's like a professor here." I'm like, "Like,
what?
Professor X is really a professor? Like, in real life? Like, what's happening?" So I was like, maybe, I don't know, like, where is it? He's like, oh, no, it's, like, right in that auditorium, like, right across from our dorm. It's happening in, like, 10 minutes. I'm like, what? This is, like, I'm just, it's, like, blew my mind. So I just literally just walked right out of my dorm, right across the little walkway, and walk in, and there's a bunch of students, and they bring Patrick out. He looked a little different because he had a mustache. I think a lot of his roles, he might, I might be wrong, shave clean, but
yeah.
But so he comes out, he's got a mustache, and a guy interviews him and on stage. And I remember one of the things that he was talking about was, you know, because he started, if I'm not mistaken, he started out doing plays. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how he really got his start. And it sounded like something he was really passionate about. And then he talked about how his transition going to Hollywood and everything. And he said one thing that stood out to me, he was saying that, like, when he would act, he said, like, acting in front of a camera, it's like kind of how you were describing earlier. It's almost a completely different beast. Mm-hmm. And he said what he would do is when he would perform, he would go, he wouldn't talk to the director. He would go directly to the camera operator. And I think this is even maybe before when they were still shooting on film. So there wasn't, like, playback. Mm-hmm. And he would ask him, like, you're looking through the viewfinder. What do I look like? Because you're looking into my eyes. Like, what subtle things do I need to change to make my performance better, to make it more authentic? Yeah. So that kind of stood out to me. And then he was talking about how he really wanted to get back to the roots. And then I think he was doing Macbeth. They toured Macbeth just because he really wanted to get back to his original roots after being in Hollywood for so long. But the funny part of the story is, so this guy's interviewing him on the stage, and we're in this little auditorium, and I guess what you would call the quote unquote president of the college, which we called, I think, the master there. They all have all these weird British names.
The master.
Shout out to the UK. got some homies out there. Yeah. So the master. It's time to end the interview. We got to wrap this thing up. And I mean, Patrick in the interview, I mean, they're just having a ball. They're, like, laughing and everything. And you see the master, he's got a 3-piece suit on, and he's kind of sort of behind them, but slightly to the side. And he kind of just starts etching up so he's etching up with his feet, kind of getting a little bit closer to him. And then he's like, what? And, like, he's trying to cut it, and they're not paying attention. And this happened for, like, a couple of minutes. Finally, he was like, puts his hands together. Well, Patrick, I think we need to wrap this thing up. You know, it was a pleasure having you. But it was a good time. And I really enjoyed that. Anyway,
I've heard he's a very goofy man, Patrick Stewart. I've never met him, but I've heard he's lovely.
Yeah. He seemed like a really nice guy. He was definitely, you know, good humored and yeah, cool accent and everything. So,
and a really great shiny head. I like him
nice
so much.
Nice head.
He's got a good head.
Let's talk about Agent real quick. So how did you, cause I know you came down here and you met your agent after you'd moved back to the South. How did you find your agent, or how did your agent find you?
Well, in the South, it's a very different beast. So in New York and LA, it is very hard to get representation. It can take years, it can take loads of interviews and lots of rejection. In the South, you literally just pick one and you go into the office and you say you want to work and they'll give you a try. So it was not hard. That's not to say my agent isn't very good. The Avenue is an excellent agency and I'm grateful to be part. And I know that they don't sign everyone, but to be perfectly honest, without sounding haughty, I just want to tell the truth. Walking into an agency in the South with off-Broadway credits and an NYU honors BFA, you know, was easy. So it was really mm-hmm. just a matter of I met with a few and picked the one I like, and that was that. That is not how it worked in New York or LA.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, but because you, I guess, sort of had a gold star that, you know, a lot of people that have those credentials aren't here.
Exactly.
They're up there.
Yeah.
You sort of stood out.
Up there, I was, you know, a small fish in a big pond, and mm-hmm. here I'm a big fish in a small pond.
And do you still do plays at all, or are you mostly focusing on film?
You know, I have not done a play locally in probably 2.5 or 3 years. The only play I did was The Moment in DC, because I really wanted to. I had to go to New York to audition for that one, and it had some actors and a director that I really wanted to work with. but I haven't. Theater is a huge time commitment and doesn't pay very well. So when you're starting a business like Branded, it's much better to just do an occasional film shoot here and there. They're usually more money and less hours. So right now, sort of the sacrifice and compromise I've made in order to do Branded as well is to focus on film and television.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Can we talk about screenplays a little bit?
Yeah.
You've written a little bit.
I have written a little bit.
Could you tell me about maybe your first screenplay?
Yeah. I have not written anything that has been published, and I haven't even tried. Mm-hmm. Nor have I tried, you know, I read somebody's book on screenwriting that says that you have to write like 100 of them before you have a good one. And I believe that could very well be true. So I have tried many times to write a screenplay. I have only written 3 full length.
And are we talking about when full length, we're talking feature film?
Feature film for 90 to 110 pages.
And these screenplays, these are not for theater. These are for films,
correct?
No,
these are for film. Yeah. So my dream as a little girl was to have a production company and make movies. Mm-hmm. I have not, to be honest with you, I don't know why, but I haven't even tried. Life is funny like that, I guess. So at the moment, my writing is really for me, and I love to keep it that way. So acting became, I have a very, you know, a tumultuous relationship with acting because the moment that it becomes a form of income, it gets really messy. So for me, writing has always just been fun, and it's a way of keeping me sane, and it's free, mm-hmm. unlike a therapist, which is also necessary for sanity. But so for me, screenwriting, usually what happens is I'll write a screenplay and I realize I really want it to be a novel because screenplays are meant to be seen, not read. The final product is that it's visual. And I guess for me writing, usually what happens is I'll try and make it a screenplay and then I turn it into a short story or a novel because that's just more fun. Screenplays are so technical. It's like science and art. And I haven't figured out how to enjoy that the way that I enjoy a short story or a novel.
You've taken sort of the reverse approach of Hollywood where instead of taking a great novel and then adapting it to screen, you take a great screenplay and then adapt that into a novel. Is that?
Well, none of them have been great. Uh-huh. I take a screenplay. But yeah, kind of. Though sometimes I'll like bounce back and forth. Like I'm working on a novel right now. And again, this is all just for pleasure. But like sometimes if I can't get into it, if it feels like it's dead to me that day, or if I can't find a way into that story, I might take a break and write that scene as a play or as a screenplay. So I'm really just toying with dialogue at that point. And that can be a really great way to get back into the story. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe not even as simple as doing one and then the other. It's kind of at the same time.
I want to start talking about your company.
Yeah.
I know we've been talking a lot about acting, which I've enjoyed. The name of your company, it's Branded Collective, correct?
Yes.
How did you come up with that name?
Well, originally the company was called T615, the 615 being the area code of Nashville, and the area code, mm-hmm. right? Not zip code. I get those confused. And the T was shorthand for tribute and then also for the fact that we were selling t-shirts. But Branded was actually originally just a collection of cuffs, and we had put the word Branded on these cuffs along with a number. We started at 1 and we went up. And we sold 100 cuffs for $100, and that was the upstart for our company. And the reason we stamped them with Branded is because many survivors of human trafficking are physically branded, like a cow. Sometimes it's a tattoo or a knife cut or a burn, but it's a way that their pimp, it's a lot like what happened in the Holocaust. It's a way that the quote-unquote owner lets the slave know that they're property. So we branded these cuffs with that word and with a number, and we encouraged people to purchase a number in honor of those who had been branded and help us start this company. And the business model at that time was that we were going to sell shirts and maybe some jewelry, and 25% of our profits would go to a nonprofit called In Slavery Tennessee. So we were pretty, I guess, charity-based in that we made things, sold things, and gave a large chunk of our income to this company. Over the years, we have developed into a jobs program. So what we realized when working with In Slavery is that a lot of their clients, apart from being these extraordinarily capable, smart women, are also a little weary of welfare, if you will, and being given. and they really want to earn and experience that thrill of getting valuable work and valuable training and valuable income that they earned on their own. So we eliminated the giving and instead opened up job opportunities. And so our giving is in salary as opposed to in just a donation. That was a long answer.
No, it's fine. It's perfect. So, and I just want to be clear for folks, so we can clarify, but so your company Branded Collective, what you guys do is you guys sell, jewelry, mm-hmm. mostly cuffs, like bangles, I guess. Could you call them mm-hmm. bangles?
Yeah, sure.
So, sort of like bangles. For men out there listening that have no idea what we're talking about, you'll have to go check them out online and so you can see.
And men
do wear our products.
Yourself.
But yeah, they're kind of like, it's like a bracelet, but one that's not, it's more like a cuff. It's solid. It's not linked. It's not links that sort of move around that are attached to one another. But anyway, so you guys sell these bracelets, and these bracelets are made, handmade mm-hmm. by women mm-hmm. who were formerly in the sex trade. They yes. were formerly sex trafficking victims who are now survivors
yes.
of sex trafficking. And you mentioned In Slavery Tennessee. Could you, which is a nonprofit here in Nashville.
Yes.
Could you describe, because you guys partner with them and give them, mm-hmm. say, 25%?
No, now okay. we don't. So okay. we, instead of giving, we use that money to hire more survivors.
Hire more survivors.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now, could you describe In Slavery Tennessee? What
yeah.
exactly do they do?
So they are the single point of contact in, I believe, the state of Tennessee, or maybe the Middle Tennessee. I think it's the state of Tennessee, for survivors when they are found at a sting. So In Slavery takes care of, they receive young women who have been identified as survivors of human trafficking. And that process is kind of out of my wheelhouse, but it's between, you know, the TBI, which is Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, and caseworkers and the staff at In Slavery. So there's a lot of people that are involved in this process. But once someone is identified as an unwilling, which that's controversial because I think at the end of the day, nobody is willing, but anyhow, when someone has been identified as a trafficked victim in slavery is in I don't know that it's a formal partnership. I'm not sure how the relationship works, but they work very closely with TBI and they receive these young women and boys as their clients. And In Slavery offers them everything from medical help, counseling. A lot of these people have criminal records because they've, you know, in addition to being trafficked, they're often involved in drugs and, you know, things get, when you're in that situation, you get desperate and they do things like stealing or whatever. So they help them with everything, you know, getting in and out of jail, counseling, custody of children, or figuring out if that's even something that they need to have right now. So they do everything.
The full spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And they are an extraordinary organization. Mm-hmm. And they have a absolutely fabulous staff and take care of their clients very well. Mm-hmm. So
how old are these women and sometimes young men mm-hmm. that they're helping?
They help. I mean, the youngest that I have met was 12. Mm-hmm. But I believe, I mean, you can be trafficked as an infant. So, mm-hmm. and I don't know if I haven't met any of their infant clients. I don't know that they have any, but I know that they get very, very young. We do not hire anyone younger than 18 for obviously just for, because we are a for-profit social enterprise. So we legally cannot hire, you know, younger than 18, but no, they've got very young mm-hmm. little ones.
Yeah. So the age range can be from very, very young mm-hmm. to maybe mid-20s generally, or?
Well, I mean, you can be trafficked all the way to, you know, they've
any
had,
age.
We've had clients that were in their 40s. However, the In Slavery does seem to have more young, they're working with younger women. I mean, our average is probably 25, early 20s to 25, our employees.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
and I know that there's a lot of sensitivity around the identities of these women a lot mm-hmm. of times because, yeah, they're in a very vulnerable state. And oftentimes these women have, you mentioned pimp earlier, so mm-hmm. someone that's has a lot of psychological control over them.
Yeah. And you know what? I feel like I learned recently at a conference on human trafficking that I'm not supposed to call them pimps. They have name now. And I have no idea what that is.
Yeah.
So you
trafficker.
Have to do a
we'll just say,
trafficker. I
we'll
think that's actually right. Yeah. So you may have
I'll be politically incorrect. Okay. I'm fine being politically incorrect on my podcast, I think it's important. In a sense, it is important to say that because I want people out there to understand what we're talking about. Because sometimes when people think of human trafficking, they might think of something that's happening in another country, and there's this, but they're not thinking maybe I want to get a prostitute and she has a pimp. It's like, whatever. It's kind of almost culturally sort of, I don't want to say funny, but it's minimizing
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay. That's just whatever. Like,
yeah, we have songs about pimps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We have songs about it and everything. So, but this is what we're talking about. You know, a lot of these women, as she mentioned, are very young, are under the age of 18, and, they don't, you know, and we can get into some stories, but yeah, they don't have a lot of control. For different reasons. And there is a lot of psychological control that these men will have over them where they may threaten them. They may threaten. I've heard stories of threatening to kill their families if they try to run, if they try to get away. And especially because, you know, these women are so young, they believe it. And a lot of times these threats, they may or may not be valid, but to them it's real. And they say, you know, I can't take the chance of something happening to my family or my children that I'm just going to stay here with this guy. Is there a story in particular of a young woman that you know, or that you've heard her story that you could tell folks?
We really get various parts of their stories in sort of snippets. So, you know, what they've come from is so traumatic and shaming that honestly, they're not always telling us their stories in full. What will happen is that while we're working on jewelry, they might share a little experience or a snippet of what has happened. And I'm trying to be sensitive here because there are no names, so I won't be sharing names, obviously. But, you know, some of our gals, common themes, I guess, we've had more than one whose mom was the original trafficker. Mm-hmm. The mom needed drug money. And so, you know, she had a lovely little daughter, and that was her answer to get drug money. And maybe it started with selling her to the family, and then from there it went out. And that, to me, is one of the most heartbreaking narratives, because if you can't trust your mom, then imagine the trust issues that you're going to have. A lot of them very commonly have an intense emotional connection with their trafficker. They may even, you know, I've heard a few of them say that they still love him, or they'll have to go to a court session to get him put behind bars or whatever, and they are afraid to see him again because they know that they'll want to protect him or they'll love him. Because that's a key way that they're lured in, is that he will speak love to them and then, you know, buy things. And a lot of these young women do come from backgrounds where they were undervalued. So to have a man shower them with, you know, praise and love and tell them how pretty they are and buy them things, they'd just do anything for him. So, you know, deeper down that relationship, when he says, ah, we need money, then it just kind of spirals. We've had many of our employees tell us that they have been terribly beaten or taught how to make meth or whatever. And then, you know, that's one way that they keep them. They force the girls to do something illegal. So then they say, well, you can't run away now because you'll be pinned as a drug trafficker or whatever. We definitely have had a couple just disappear. They just leave. Some have come back, some don't. Relapses happen. I mean, you know, it can, we've definitely, you know, we've been lied to. The level of trauma, I think I went into it kind of naively thinking, man, we're going to provide these jobs and give these gals something to be, you know, inspired by. But I think what I've come face to face with in this opportunity, in this colliding with their stories, is that when you've had that level of trauma, it takes so much time to heal. So I'm not really telling you specific stories, which I know is what everybody wants, but I'm just trying to be real sensitive to what I've been given.
Sure.
But those are some of the narratives that we encounter on a daily basis.
Sure. Could you describe to folks the distinction in terminology between survivor and victim?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know that there's, you know, if there's like a technical difference, then I probably won't be able to give you that. But mm-hmm. I know that the hope in the sort of the abolitionist community, and I'm really new at like, so, you know, my background obviously is theater and sort of dappling in entrepreneurialism. So starting to work within slavery, I'm learning new lingo and I'm learning what to say and what not to say. Like I said, the, you know, trafficker versus pimp, I'm still confused. I don't know. But I think the reason that we, what I have heard and what I agree with, the reason that, that by and large we avoid the word victim is because that's not my choice. I can't look at you and tell you you're a victim. You get to decide that. So to say survivor isn't, it's an honorable way to label, if you even have to have a label. And I know a lot of these young women and men, I'm sure, don't even want that. They want to get away from all, they don't want to be a survivor. They don't want to be a victim. They don't want to be identified anymore by this horrible thing. But I think survivor is definitely a better, you know, if you tell yourself every day that you're a mean person, you're going to start believing you're a mean person or that you're stupid or that you're whatever. So to call them a victim isn't helpful. So if there's like a technical difference, I don't know. But I know that we're encouraged to use the word survivor because it's an honorable term and because that is who they are.
Yeah.
Extraordinary survivors. And I really do think that you can be victimized, but you get to decide if you're a victim. Anybody can victimize me, but I will not be a victim. Mm. And I think that's why we use those words.
How did you first get interested in trying to make a difference in human trafficking?
I grew up in the church, like I said, and I've always heard about, you know, poverty and all the different things that we could go on mission trips for. But for some reason, this particular, I don't know why. I think, I can't help but think it must be part of my womanness, but just to know that, that this kind of, I was very sheltered growing up. So when I heard about this being a thing, it broke my heart in a way that other atrocities just don't break my heart. I have a very easily broken heart. Actually, I'm way too sensitive, I think. But this one just crushes me. And the thought that someone could be so mistreated, I mean, to be violated sexually at such a young age, that just messes with you. And, you know, you can be born into poverty and that's so hard. But man, imagine, you know, if something happens and you're able to get out of that, and it can become a really, and I'm not trying to minimize poverty or other things, but to come from poverty and come out of that is awesome. But to grow up being raped multiple times a day, and then to come out of that, I mean, that, I don't want to sound hopeless, but I feel like there's a level of trauma that just doesn't go away when that's your story. And I hope that's not true, but it's just so broken. It's so broken. And I think I went into it hoping that I could abolish human trafficking at large. And what I'm learning is that I don't think that's my job. This is why I think I'm becoming to believe in God again, because there has to be one for atrocities this large, and he has to be good.
And why do you say, when you say there has to be one for atrocities this large, you mean because that's the only solution?
Yeah,
or what do you?
I think so. I think that is the only solution. I mean, maybe over time, little by little, the human race can eradicate human trafficking, but it's been around from the beginning of time. And I believe that we're going to need, I continue to want to chip away at this, and I continue to want to do my little part in advancing the abolition and in helping survivors get back on their feet. But as far as erasing this entire tragedy from the human race, I think we have to have something bigger than any human being.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I think, I think you're getting at something in terms of, I think it's a heart problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, I mean, none of us, we live in an imperfect world and everyone has their own faults.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be the first to say that about myself. But yeah, it's like, you know, are we going to make every single person in the world a good person so that this doesn't happen? It's crazy. But it's such a hairy problem. Yeah, that's almost what it would take.
Yeah. No, it is. I think it's exactly what it would take, because you know, you can put laws up, you can continue to heal the hurt, but until you stop the people that want to be doing this, you're mm-hmm. you can't. It's going to keep happening.
Yeah, And also, I don't want to say that as a discouragement too, because folks, I think the difficulty is sometimes when we see these problems that are just so large, it's like, I think people get drowned.
Yeah.
By them. Like, I can't make any difference. I guarantee you, trust me, if someone you loved was this type of trauma was happening to them, or you knew about that, mm-hmm. you would bend over backwards to do anything you could mm-hmm. for that person that you loved. And so I say that to say, with a problem this size, I think just thinking about what you can do for one person mm-hmm. is always where you start. And so, if you live here locally to Nashville, and you work with enslavers, so you can probably clarify this a little bit more. I know that there are different groups that are affiliated with enslavery that meet, I don't know if it's on a monthly basis, but they're spread throughout the Nashville metropolitan area. So you can plug with them. But wherever you live, there may be an organization that's working. So I would definitely check that out and look into it. Also, I would encourage you to check out Branded Collective, because you're really we know where the source of these things are coming from. With a lot of things that people buy, it's funny. I think it was Nike a while back got into big trouble because they had all these sweatshops that they had like children working in, and mm-hmm. that's, I guess, would be a sort of another form of
labor trafficking. Yeah.
Human trafficking in that way. And I'm not going to knock Nike, because I don't even think they realized that, and they corrected. And I think they really took a hard look at their supply chain after that. But it is true that there, a lot of times we don't know the source of whatever we're eating, whatever mm-hmm. we're wearing is coming from.
Which kind of goes back to our earlier conversation mm-hmm. about taking something for granted, and that the root of that, there's this level of ignorance. You just haven't looked at mm-hmm. how grateful you are for something. And I think sometimes it's that gratitude that can ignite the desire to say, wow, what is this really that I'm grateful for? Mm-hmm. And that may be where part of, I think, Americans by and large, including myself, can take for granted mm-hmm. things anyway.
No, it's fine. But I guess the flip side of that is, while we're not always going to know where things come from. And I think there is, I can't remember the name of the organization. You guys can probably Google this, but there is an organization that built an app that I think when you go in a store, you can scan the barcode, and it gives a grade, I think, from A to F on how clean the supply chain is human trafficking wise for that product. So you guys can maybe check that out or do some more research on that. But what I was going to say is, with Branded Collective, not only do you know that it's coming from a good source, but the complete opposite, you know that you're helping someone that has been in a traumatic situation get back on their feet, and you're giving them opportunity. So, do we have a little bit more time, or?
Yeah, we can go a wee bit longer.
Wee bit longer. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about your jewelry, which it's funny. I grew up really into jewelry. I don't know.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Like, I don't know why I liked it, but I guess it was just, like when I was in middle school, it's like, who had the biggest chain,
yeah.
around their neck, like who had the most shine,
yeah.
And I had a pretty big chain. I bought it was like a huge thick chain I'm kind of glad that I think a lot of people didn't, it actually is real, it was silver, but I'm thinking in retrospect, I'm kind of glad a lot of people thought that was real, cause I might've had some more problems, but yeah, I think since growing up, and I try not to be too materialistic. I do like some things, but apart from that, I'm just so simple. I get up, I don't want to put extra stuff on. That being said, I was checking out your jewelry, and I really dig it. It's the designs are really good, and I'm a very visual kind of design person. I think that's why I probably like jewelry, is because I like the craftsmanship mm-hmm. and I appreciate it. But yeah, you guys have some really cool stuff, and I will be purchasing something that I will wear. As someone who is not big into jewelry anymore, I will be wearing probably one of your cuffs.
Oh, good. So, thank you. Well, we have some leather ones coming out this year. So.
Got leather ones too. Okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. So I want you to talk about what types of jewelry you guys are offering. Are you're wearing earrings now. Are those?
No, these are not. These are actually another local artist. So these are considered the Wildflower. So we do want to introduce earrings and rings, but some of those things require a burning or a melting process, and we don't have our own space yet to do that. So we make all of our cuffs either at my house or Lauren's or in our trunks at In Slavery.
And Lauren, tell the folks who Lauren is.
Yes, Lauren is my incredible co-founder. She is the one that really, I tend to be more of the idea crazy person, and Lauren has this extraordinary mind that is both creative and very business. So she handles data sheets and spreadsheets, and she keeps the ship going where it's going.
She's the CFO, and you're the crazy CEO with all the ideas, and she's keeping you in check. Making sure that we can make things practical.
Yeah, we tend to avoid labels just because I always feel like CEO is like somehow like the top, and I feel very much like we are equals. We are side by side because I would crumble without her. She'd probably keep going without me. So,
Do you have jewelry for both men and women right now?
Right now, we just call it all unisex. Obviously, our buyers are predominantly women. Usually that is the case with jewelry lines. But a lot of men do wear our cuffs. They usually wear the smaller ones in the copper or the aluminum because copper gets all like, you know, patinaed and it looks like a penny and it's really masculine and cool. But we do. We have both. And as we grow, we focused more because we're a young, new company. We really focus more on selling what works. So we stuck toward the more dainty feminine. But we are about to introduce a leather wrap that's in collaboration with Mission Lazarus, who I mentioned earlier. So it'll be a collaborative piece that we'll have one for women and one for men.
Now, what is that collaboration? Is there going to be a portion that goes to that organization, or how does that collaboration work?
Well, essentially, we are making a blank, a small 2-inch brass blank, and on it we are stamping a phrase, which I will not tell you yet. Okay. And it'd be very inspirational. And we will, so survivors of trafficking will make, stamp, and polish that blank, and then it will be sent with the staff at Mission Lazarus to Honduras, and they will then attach it to a really swanky, cool leather wrap. Part of the story behind this collaboration is that they are using and we are using our scraps, our leftover pieces, to create this item. So, you know, I guess the idea is sort of that beauty from ashes or using what's been discarded to create something beautiful. And again, I wish Lauren was here because she does the finances, but we're both benefiting. You know, they're employees. They're similar to us in that they're providing job opportunity for people that need it. Yeah. So their people are getting work and our people are getting work, and it'll be a fun piece.
That's great. That's great. Let's talk about the numbers in the letters. Could you describe what people are like? What are they doing?
What are we talking about? The alphabet.
Could you describe that?
Yes. So every item that we make includes a few things. It usually includes our logo, not always, depending on our design limitations, but usually it says branded. It also will always include a number. And so we started early on stamping 100 numbers on 100 cuffs and encouraging people to purchase this unique number in honor of a survivor. And so the numbers represent our collective. They represent how many people have joined this movement to provide job opportunity and healing to survivors of human trafficking. We're about to stamp our 20,000th cuff.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. So our collective has really grown. I mean, we stamped those first 100 and thought, oh, nobody's ever going to buy a number on a cuff. Let's just see if this works. We liked the idea. We weren't sure. And here we are 20,000 strong.
That is one unique piece. Custom number on it.
Yep. Nobody has that number but you, which is a perfect segue into what you can now do with our numbers. So let's say you purchase a cuff. And you're, 19,000, you can take that number and register it on our website, and you can send a message of hope to our survivors. So if you go to our website, there's something called the Collective Voices page, and you can read messages of hope from all over the world, actually. And these are people who have purchased a number that just want to say something positive to our girls, our women. And so you can either do it to send your message of hope just to the branded family, to all of our employees, or on every cuff, there is a little initial, and that is the woman that made that cuff. And you can send a message directly to her.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. Now, if folks want to buy one of your pieces or multiple, where can they do that?
Yeah, they can do that many places. They can do that on our website. That maybe the fastest way, I suppose, if you're not in Nashville. Or we are also, if you go to our website, there's a shop local page and you can see where we are throughout the United States. And I actually think we just shipped something to Germany. So we might have gone international with our wholesale accounts, which is exciting. I don't know for sure, but I think we're in the process of that account. So right now we have about 40 wholesale accounts. So we're still small, but it, you know, depending on where you live, you could be close to a boutique that carries our stuff. Otherwise, catch us at a fair, a live event, which is also posted on our social media, or just buy it on our website.
Okay. Okay. Now, there may be someone listening to this that owns a jewelry store or a line of jewelry stores. Do you guys wholesale, or are you guys open to having other stores sell your item, your
products? Yes, we love that. We do wholesale. You can sign up for a wholesale account on our website, or you can email me, Emily, at brandedcollective.com, or info at brandedcollective.com, or Lauren at brandedcollective.com. So, yeah, we absolutely love wholesale accounts.
How are we doing on time? Probably should start to wrap.
Yeah, I should probably. I just got an email from Lauren that says, we really need more letters.
Okay. So, we're going to start to bring this thing to a close. But before I do so, I want to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Let's say someone out there is listening and they have an idea of starting a business. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that person?
I would say do it and do it ethically. And if it fails, do it again or do something else, but always do it ethically.
Now, what are some ways that they could do it ethically?
I think depending on what you're selling or what your idea is, if you know, if it's a service, then you know, I think for branded, we're always wanting to source our products, whether it be a packaging thing or a product itself, source things in an ethical way. And what I mean by that is that's good for people and good for the earth. If we can, we obviously work with metals and jewelry, and you know, I think some of that could be very arguable. It's a controversial thing, but we do want to be ethical in everything that we do. So with our packaging, we try and use recycled paper. We even use recycled metals. We try not to have any scraps. So if we have, you know, we have a huge box full of various scraps, but we don't throw them out. We're going to use them some way. We're thinking about Christmas ornaments with some of our scraps, you know. So, you know, then obviously there's treating your employees, if you have them, well, and paying them well. We pay our survivors 12 an hour and work them up to 15. So, you know, I have a lot of friends who have hourly rates that aren't that good. And they're like, man.
And folks, just to also give context, we're also in the South here. So that's that's going to go a longer ways in Nashville than it would in somewhere
New York.
Like New York. So, or California. Now, one thing that that you mentioned that I do want to talk about briefly is your metals. Now, what metals are you guys using for your different pieces?
Currently, we use aluminum, copper, brass, sterling silver, and then we're beginning to play around with gold. We have a gold-filled piece, but we don't have any. Gold is sort of our new toy. Mm-hmm. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Now, before we go, we had, I think we had mentioned this earlier, but if folks want to find you online, what's the website?
The website is brandedcollective.com.
Perfect. Perfect. And if people want to reach out to you, do you tweet or do you have a blog or anything online?
I am on Instagram and that is it. I'm kind of an introvert, but you are welcome to reach out to me.
Okay. What's your Instagram handle?
My Instagram handle is mjoy__.
mjoy__. Okay, great.
For now.
unless she gets too many messages and then we might have to change it.
Right. No.
Well, Emily, it was a pleasure. And sorry, m_, is it E-M?
Yes, E-M.
Say it again. E-M.
J-O-Y.
J-O-Y_. So not the letter M. It's spelled M. E-M.
Yeah. Okay. M as in Emily.
M as in Emily. Okay, Emily. Well, it was a real pleasure having you. I appreciate your time and best of luck with all you're doing with Branded Collective.
Thank you, Sean. And best of luck to you. This is brilliant.
Hey, guys. Real quick before you go, I just wanted to let you know that you can find notes for this episode on our website, which is thestoriespodcast.com. The show notes include links to people and resources mentioned in the episode, and occasionally some pretty awesome quotes. There's also a place to leave a comment if there's anything you'd like to say.
or you could write your thoughts as a review on iTunes. And if you do leave a review on iTunes, I just want to let you know I really appreciate it. It really helps create more visibility for the podcast, so thanks. Oh, and one more thing. If you do leave a review on iTunes, please put your Twitter handle at the bottom of your review. I've been known to occasionally send thank you tweets out. But no promises. See you guys next week.